Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Hollywood legend Paul Newman, the man with the most famous blue eyes in movie history, who had pretty much what sounds like a charmed life. Born in Cleveland, Ohio, growing up in an affluent Shaker Heights neighborhood, ran the family sporting goods store. And then he got kicked out of Ohio University because he apparently dented the college president's car with a beer keg, served 3 years in the U.S. Navy during World War II as a radio operator, graduated of college, married his first wife, ended up at the Yale University School of Drama, where when he was doing a play, he was spotted by two agents. Okay, Mike, whose life ever unfolds like this for Hollywood so beautifully? I mean, yes, isn't it enough to be born absolutely gorgeous and rich and talented with blue eyes, but then the world just opens for you like your oyster? How does that happen, Mike?
Since you've already mentioned the famous blue eyes, I have to tell you very quickly, I met the blue eyes. In 1992, I met Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward at an event. And I've got to say very quickly, it was a crowded event and it was just a fast hello and so on. But the reason it's worth mentioning for me is, face to face and seeing that handsome face and those blue eyes. I mean, they were incredibly piercing. They had that quality of, like, some people have, like you said, well, those are nice blue eyes, but these were like penetrating, piercing blue eyes. And the moment you see a face like that, you realize not only how photogenic it is, but in terms of actors who have that ability to hold the camera. Speaking of eyes, the camera eye. Simply being handsome or beautiful is not in itself always enough. There's that quality, which is more difficult to put into words, of what holds the camera eye. And he had that profile. He had a face. So whether the film was good or bad, he had that presence to him and that confidence and that charisma. And that explains a lot. That's part of the charm life that you were referring to, actually. I would love to have grown up that way and with that face and with those blue eyes. I mean, it's too late for the blue eyes for me, but maybe too late in other ways too. But getting back to the biography you mentioned, in some ways you could say, isn't that a charm life? Like, it's distinctive. And yet there's a generational quality here. He's of that greatest generation, if you will. It's not coincidental in some ways on a symbolic level that he grows up in the Midwest, and ends up going through, Kenyon College and serving in World War II. I mean, he's a member of that generation. Coming off of there, somebody with a college education, with military background, being at Yale, the Yale Drama School is a great launching pad. And from there to the Actors Studio in New York City. And in fact, very quickly, the career gets launched. He's in a Broadway play. It's actually original. We tend to think of Picnic in terms of the film version of it, but he was on Broadway with Picnic in 1953. So it really is a charmed existence at that point. But again, in a generational sense, he's not the only promising talent to come along. We can think of other actors like James Dean, Dennis Hopper, Marlon Brando came along a bit earlier, but essentially the same group of actors growing up at the same time, going through typically the Actor's Studio, think of method acting, everything associated with that. And then for those actors following in the immediate wake of Marlon Brando, specifically James Dean, whom we talked about in a recent episode, but also people like Paul Newman, they're, standing in a long shadow, if you know what I mean. It's just they've got Brando's presence, and always in their early film roles, critics invariably make the comparisons. Well, he's good, but he's no Brando, stuff like that, right? And I'd say, yeah, but he's better looking, for one thing, things you could point out that way. But one of the generational attributes, and this is a mixed blessing, if you will, is that when they get noticed in theater and early television roles, things like that, and in the early 1950s, what happens, of course, is the movie studios notice, and particularly with the Broadway production of Picnic, they notice, promising talent like that. Paul Newman and James Dean were among the last generation of young actors to sign a conventional studio contract. That traditional like 5-year contract or 7-year contract. He signs with Warner Brothers in 1955. And, at that point, the good part of it is, hey, a major Hollywood studio, you're under contract, you're making movies. But the first movie he made, Silver Chalice, in that same year, was a complete dud. Critical and commercial failure. And Newman himself loved to joke about it in later years. He said, what a bad way to start a film career. It's like a really terrible film. But because he had that promise, and frankly, because he had those good looks, he wasn't exactly washed up. It was just like a very unpromising first film. So again, joining in a bit more on what you were saying at the outset, it is a charmed way to grow up and to get into show business. But what I was adding to it was simply there's also that generational component. He's one among actors, and not all of them will have the lasting success that Paul Newman has, but they all are coming in at about the same point.
It's also this idea of being discovered rather than going out looking for it, in that, you know, you're right, the actors you're talking about, Marlon Brando and James Dean and Paul Newman, they did not strike out for Hollywood and, you know, end up sleeping in their car and all that kind of stuff before they made it big. You know, I guess the field was a little smaller too, a few less.
Well, I would allow for James Dean maybe sleeping in the car once in a while.
You're right.
He was not a particularly good driver, but he was a fast driver and drove all the time. And of course, Paul Newman would be a driver too, race cars, a better driver, a safer driver than James Dean. But James Dean was knocking around quite a bit, sleeping in friends' apartments and all that stuff, you know, knocking around New York. So I wouldn't leave a car out of the equation necessarily that way. You know, joking aside on this, here's an interesting biographical connection about how closely linked this generation of actors was. In 1955, James Dean and Paul Newman were scheduled to co-star in a TV movie based on an Ernest Hemingway short story. And the reason that the project itself eventually went ahead with Paul Newman in it, James Dean was killed in that car accident, you know, all joking aside, of course, at this point, you know, he dies in a car wreck on September 30th, 1955. And so just at the point where he and Paul Newman were going to appear on screen together, you know, one of them is gone forever, of course, as a legend, as an almost mythic figure now. But you can see how that, and this is why I was prefacing it the way I did, that some of these careers are long, like Paul Newman's, others, sad to say, really tragic, like James Dean, or, you know, tragically cut short in 1955. And there are other actors like Brando, even, you know, the greatest of them all, but still, you know, Brando has a kind of checkered track record, to put it mildly, in much of his later career. But Paul Newman, you know, really, once he established himself, I mean, not every movie's great, but he had a lasting presence, certainly, for all those decades afterwards.
He says that almost everything he learned about being an actor came from those early years at the Actor's Studio. And also that once he started taking drama classes, he asked himself why he had ever wasted so much time on a football team. He also said, "I had no natural gift to be anything, not an athlete, not an actor, not a writer, not a director, a painter of garden porches, not anything. So I've worked really hard because nothing ever came easily to me." And in terms of reminding people of Brando, early on, he was often mistaken for Marlon Brando. So he claims to have signed around 500 autographs reading, "Best wishes, Marlon Brando."
Well, speaking of the actor's presence, he worked really hard at his acting, but this is the significant thing. Paul Newman worked really hard at his acting, but the whole goal, the agenda was to make it look like it wasn't hard, to make it look like it was easy and natural. Some actors, when they're working hard, they want you to know every twitch, every gesture, every affectation. And it might be a great performance, but it could be a very studied performance, right? Or a very self-conscious performance somehow. With Paul Newman, the whole trick there throughout his career was to make it look like he was not acting, that he was just that character in, you know, kind of casual, easygoing way, even if the character himself was a difficult person, to make it seem easy that way. And the best quote I ever saw about Paul Newman as an actor, and this would cover the entire career, comes from Pauline Kael, the New Yorker magazine film critic. She really liked Paul Newman, and she reviewed a lot of his films over the years. And it's a very incisive quote, so I'll give it, and it's just a few words, actually. She describes Paul Newman this way: casual American star acting at its peak. Every word registers there. It's casual. You just feel like you're watching the guy, you know, he's in blue jeans and he's walking down the street, or that athletic quality you mentioned before. He could be, you know, a race car driver or any number of other things, but it's just the natural character, if you will. American. There is something distinctively American about Paul Newman. Now, that's easily identified. To explain it in greater detail, you know, you could sort of trip yourself up on your words as to what makes it American and not something, you know, I don't want to get like semantically sidetracked with that. But when you see him, you know, you're looking at an American actor. The way he speaks, the way he dresses, something about the personality. So casual American star acting. It is star acting. He's not one of those actors so totally lost in the part that you forget, oh, and then that's who it is. No. You always know it's Paul Newman. So he's very much a movie star, but so casual about it, that it's so easygoing that you don't feel like he's showing off. You just feel like, well, if you have a handsome face and those piercing blue eyes we keep talking about, yeah, there's no mistaking, there's no masking it. Why, you know, and so in profile, you know, that's a great profile. And, you know, he's the star of the film. So all that's there, but again, not in a way where you feel like you're just watching a movie star vehicle. And that's an important distinction. Some movie stars have films where, whether the film's good or bad, it's a vehicle for the actor. That would have been pragmatically the case for Paul Newman when he's, you know, anchoring a film, but you don't feel that way as you watch it. You feel like he's become that character. So Pauline Kael nailed it in just those few words. And true to my form, I've spent about 10 times as many words elaborating on that. So I'll give it over to you at this point.
Well, one of his detached yet charismatic anti-heroes and rebels can be seen in the role he plays in 1958's The Long Hot Summer, which, you know, he made with Joanne Woodward. She actually became pregnant during production, only to miscarry on their honeymoon, less than a month before the world premiere. And then they, of course, had to work with Orson Welles, who was apparently difficult, I guess is the kind way to put it. But he, you know, you have to, if you watch the movie, take a look at the fake nose that Orson Welles is wearing, because he would sweat on the set and the nose would slip. So, you know, makeup people had to keep applying, you know, things to keep his fake nose from falling off. So, you know, it had to be bad enough to be filming this in Louisiana during a heat wave with a fake nose and having to be Orson Welles. But he was apparently a complete pill. And the director was forever known as, after this movie, as the man who tamed Orson Welles, because during filming, he drove Welles to a local swamp, kicked him out of the car, and forced him to find his own way back.
Well, you know, Orson Welles early in his career was an enfant terrible, and then later in his career was just a monster. I mean, a tremendous talent. I mean, the great respect that, you know, I have for him, but not an easy person. Now, you put it well, the polite way is to say he could be difficult. And to work with him on a film, particularly when he's brought on for a character role like that and starts to dominate the proceedings, you know, he's not going to listen to the director. He's going to be imperious with the other actors. But anyway, that's definitely something there. That's one of the breakthrough films, but not really the only breakthrough film from the late 50s. So even though Silver Chalice from 55 is a big dud, he follows it up pretty quickly by playing the boxer Rocky Graziano in Robert Wise's Somebody Up There Likes Me in 1956. Again, Paul Newman had that athletic quality. And, you know, we're going to talk about the race car driving and all the stuff he liked to do in his private life. But on screen, he would play athletes or characters that had athletic qualities. And so that was turned to good advantage. He also had, when he wanted to, anti-hero qualities that get brought out in a number of roles. And not coincidentally, you know, when he appears in Westerns, you know, later on in the career of Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. But early in the career, he plays Billy the Kid in Arthur Penn's The Left-Handed Gun in 1958. That's an important film both for Paul Newman as an actor and for Arthur Penn as a director. And again, this is a generation of actors coming out of theater in New York, coming out of television, you know, things like that. They've got a similar background. Also, Marie, to your point, 1958 is one of the great years for Paul Newman. You mentioned The Long Hot Summer, but also that same year, he receives an Oscar nomination for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. We should pause for a moment and talk about where American pop culture is at that point. William Faulkner had received the Nobel Prize in Literature. It's not surprising that there'd be, you know, at least loose screen adaptations, versions of, you know, Faulkner stories. Also, Tennessee Williams was at his absolute peak at that point as a Broadway success. So that, you know, when Paul Newman's making movies, those movies in particular in the late 50s, you'd have William Faulkner, Tennessee Williams, you know, a lot of it being, you know, Southern folkloric kind of material in some ways, but amenable or lending itself to star casting. These are outsized characters sometimes. So yeah, Orson Welles is outsized as a character for sure. But you also, you know, have major movie stars, you know, Elizabeth Taylor and so on, you know, actors who really can fill those roles. And in terms of sexuality on the screen, you still have the production code, but you have some plot elements, right? And character elements that are pushing the envelope a bit in terms of what you can say and show and so on. And so think about that. In 1958, he makes The Left-Handed Gun, Long Hot Summer, and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Very few actors have had a year as good as that. Also, as if that weren't enough, Marie, to double back on something you said, that's the same year he marries Joanne Woodward. He had a first marriage to an actor, and that ended, but the marriage to Joanne Woodward lasted, and we'll talk more about that as we go along, but all that happening in the same year. If he had retired in 1958, we'd probably still be talking about him.
I think that marriage lasted 50 years.
It did.
And, you know, people asked him over the years, you know, what is the secret to your long marriage? And he would say, I don't know what she puts in my food. Yeah, he's a great quipster. So thank you for pointing out Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. He also made Exodus in 1960, Sweet Bird of Youth in 62, Ombre in 67, and Winning in 1969, which brings me to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Can I interject something before that?
Yes, please.
I wanted to mention Hud from 1963, because Hud is one of his most famous roles. When you think about him as being an anti-hero, very much an American anti-hero, think about that rural setting, think about the, you know, the guy who's no good, you know, comes from a good family and all this going for him, right? But he's gonna be an adult delinquent in a lot of ways, right? It's a really good film. But what's significant there in terms of the imagey cuts, it's very much, you know, out there in the open country and your blue jeans and, you know, you're going up against your family, certainly paternal authority in particular. And it becomes a kind of poster image for Paul Newman at that point. And I'll illustrate this very quickly, short of showing you posters. For Paul Newman, when he was in HUD, he received another Academy Award nomination. In fact, he received a total of 8 Academy Award nominations. He finally won for The Color of Money, which we'll get to, but, you know, nominated 8 times. He's nominated again for HUD. But here's the quick illustration I want to offer. If you've seen, that film, again, is from 1963. If you've seen a film from 1969, and you should, it's one of the great Hollywood films of the 60s, Midnight Cowboy, when the make-believe cowboy played by John Voight goes from Texas to New York City, wanting to make it, you know, as a ladies' man, to put it politely, and dressing like a cowboy and living in a Fleabag hotel, right? He does talk about John Wayne as an influence, you know, John Wayne cutting an image as a cowboy. I can be a cowboy too. But on the wall of his Fleabag hotel room, he has a poster of Paul Newman and HUD. It's never commented on, but there it is on the wall. So that's the kind of image that Newman has accrued, certainly, through the early to mid 60s. So Marie, let me hand it back to you at this point, because it absolutely does lead up to Butch Cassidy in terms of working in Westerns or quasi-Westerns.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned HUD, because HUD and The Long Hot Summer are both roles where I think you can see the comparisons to Brando and to James Dean. And then when you get to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, now suddenly you have a different kind of role for him to play, where he gets to do this buddy movie with Robert Redford. And I saw this movie. This was like, I think this was the first Paul Newman movie I had seen. And it was in a movie theater in the 70s in Japan. And we absolutely fell in love with the movie because it just had so much action. And, you know, the chemistry between the two leads is just fantastic. I wanted to mention some fun facts about the film, and that Paul Newman sawed George Roy Hill's desk in half because he wouldn't pay his bill for liquor, which he borrowed from my office. Clearly, the two leads got along very, very well, because they went on to, you know, make The Sting together, had a lifelong friendship. But really, how can you go wrong, Mike, with, you know, two of the best looking people in the world agreeing to do a buddy movie?
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned this, because think about an issue that both of those actors faced. And speaking of face, when you're incredibly handsome, the way Paul Newman was, the way Robert Redford was and still is, when you think about good looks like that, you would think that the world would be your oyster, as you mentioned earlier. In terms of critical recognition, being taken seriously as an actor, ironically, sometimes that can kind of work against you, or at least, you know, potentially work against you, because, you know, and this sounds like really silly to say out loud, but there's something to this. If somebody is that good looking an actor, can they be a good actor? And I know it sounds silly to actually put that in words, but I think that's there as a bias or a prejudice sometimes. And, you know, Earl, is it just a pretty boy actor, if you will? And for both Robert Redford and Paul Newman, it was sometimes an issue in terms of, would the critics take them seriously enough as actors? I think Newman, certainly by the late 50s, had proved himself. Redford was, you know, fairly early in his career proving himself too. But at the get-go, I think that was sometimes a reservation mentioned, or at least a kind of prejudice harbored, to put it that way. So it was really fitting that the two of them would hook up together to make, you know, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. And you're right, that chemistry was there, that rapport. And again, they're both easygoing actors. You know what I mean? They make it look easy. they're not pushing hard. And that's yet another reason why maybe they weren't taken as seriously always as they should have been. It's just simply that, oh, well, he's just there. You know, he's not, yeah, he memorizes lines, but he's just there. Well, no, he's working as hard as any actor who sweats a lot, right? But he's making it look easy. And so the two of them had that kind of rapport. And that film was such a box office hit. I mean, you know, you talk about the most important films of the 1960s, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And also not just because of the acting and that chemistry between the two male leads, but also by way of the kind of buddy-buddy movie that we now just take for granted. But it was one of the films that helped, for better or for worse, helped to launch that. You know, you think of all the cop movies in recent decades that are buddy-buddy. A lot of that spins off of Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. Also, by way of trends, the revisionist Westerns that are coming out. You know, both actors had appeared in them earlier, but this was one of the films where you start to rethink the old West. And anti-heroes increasingly are our heroes, if you will. You know, bank robbers are the good guys in some ways, you know, the characters we follow. And you can see that happening in their careers and also in Hollywood. Think about that when they follow up, like with The Sting. You can have any, you know, confidence men, shysters, gangsters, this and that, you know, people who are crooked, but they're so lovable, right? They're so endearing. They're so good looking, right? So I'm going to be on his side. Not coincidentally, you know, the same time when you have some other good looking actors like, you know, Warren Beatty and Bonnie and Clyde, 1967, you know, the gangster as a kind of hero who's much better looking than the cops and who has a name and that we somehow identify with. And so Newman was careful. He didn't get trapped in being an anti-hero. And I'm getting at, like, well, he wasn't always going to play that kind of role. And when he played it, it was such a light touch that you had to remind yourself that this guy was breaking the law, right? Because he's just such a nice guy. But, well, yes, now that you forced the point, yeah, he's breaking the law. But so what? We've all misbehaved on occasion.
Plus, they make it look like it's so much fun. So we have to, I'm just going to glance over Torn Curtain from 1966, because that was the Hitchcock movie that Paul Newman made with Julie Andrews, but it's really a forgettable film. The only thing it has going for it is that it does have Paul Newman in it. And then I'm going to gallop ahead to mention a movie from 81 that I think I also watched about 20 times because it came out on HBO, and it was called Absence of Malice. And this was, you know, where I kind of picked up Paul Newman again, because, you know, I hadn't really thought about him since The Sting, which we'll come back to. And, you know, it was good to see an actor that you already liked in something else do a completely different role and just be so good. But I do want to talk about The Sting, because that was another movie that I think I must have seen probably a dozen times. Great pairing again with Robert Redford, fantastic things that came out of it, like the music. But I wanted to mention, in terms of the two men working again together, he said in response to a radio interview who asked if he would co-star with Robert Redford in a sequel to Indecent Proposal from 1993, like a rocket, he said, I'd shack up with anyone for $1 million. I'd shack up with a gorilla for $1 million plus 10%. So The Sting.
He was always a good businessman. He's always a good actor. But, you know, I'm glad you mentioned The Sting, because, again, he's on a real roll here. He, you know, had box office hits, smash hits with Butch Cassidy, with The Sting, and so on. And then after that, 1970s is a kind of interesting decade for him, because he alternates roles. He does some things, frankly, that are just big box office. He's going for the paycheck, and why not? Towering Inferno, 1974. It's an all-star cast. He's certainly a star. You know, critically, it's not well received, and it wasn't really intended to be. It's made for a mass audience, and it works commercially. He'll do big movies like that, but then right after that, that's 1974, right after that, the next year, he takes on a role for Robert Altman, Buffalo Bill and the Indians. Not a good film particularly, but a good role for Newman. He gets to play Buffalo Bill, William Cody, and he really has a lot of fun with it. And it's yet another Paul Newman film in which he's riffing on the Western as a genre, the history of the West. And he's such an all-American actor. He's really very well cast in something like that. Then the year after that, 76, he does Slapshot, which again, you know, it's that athleticism there. The fact that, you know, here's somebody who can go around a racetrack in a car, somebody who can you know, be running around in the wilderness in the Westerns, or who can be on a hockey rink, you know, and going around there. So even though some of these are films that pay him very well, he's earning those paychecks. And as he gets into middle age, I really admire him for this. He was holding up well as an actor and also physically. He's really doing those strenuous roles in the 70s and really all over the map in terms of And most of them work commercially, not all of them, but most of them work commercially. So Marie, I'm so glad though, that as you mentioned his films from the early 80s, like Absence of Malice, not that he'd ever fallen out of favor, but he was a big box office star all through the 70s. But I think critically, he makes some of his best films in the early 80s. And I think Absence of Malice, Fort Apache, The Bronx, in terms of really good acting roles for him. So let me hand it back to you at this point, because these really are some of, I think, on the short list of Paul Newman performances, I think Absence of Malice, for which he got another Academy Award nomination, would go on that list. What do you think?
I completely agree with you, Mike. I also wanted to mention that he was the visual inspiration for the illustrations, the superhero Green Lantern, when the character was reintroduced in 59. Newman was 34 years old at the time. And you did mention, you led the way, Mike, into the discussion about his racing. He has said that the sound he loved most is that of a V8 engine. So we have about 5 minutes left, Mike. Let's talk about not only Paul Newman racing cars, but Paul Newman as the voice of a critical character in the movie Cars. He literally becomes a car.
It was so appropriate that he did that. I mean, you know, he really was serious about the racing, as we've been mentioning throughout the program today, and he was really good at it. And it really, it's part of his profile, if you will. When you read stories about him or you see his image, as often as not, in those later decades, he's either in a racing car or wearing an outfit that looks like he's ready for the track there. A man of many talents, in other words. It wasn't just some casual hobby off to the side. And the many talents included, of course, his real interest, very serious interest in philanthropic concerns that he and Joanne Woodward, through their foundation, we've all had their salad dressing at some point in Newman's own. But, you know, it's easy to make jokes there, but quite seriously, the fact that they really cared about these issues. So when he wasn't acting on screen, he might have been in a race car going around the track, but a lot of that outside of Hollywood activity had charity in mind, you know, and his businesses were very much set up with that in mind. So again, all the more reason to admire him. And the two of them really are such a serious couple. And I mean that as a supreme compliment, that they really were both serious about their acting. And in fact, he directed her in three movies, starting with Rachel in 1968. So he actually directed his wife on screen three times. And off screen, one reason why it was such a long marriage, you mentioned, you know, a happy 50-year marriage there, which is unusual by Hollywood standards, the fact that they really had those shared interests, not just as actors taking good roles and doing all they needed to really make quality film. But beyond that, they had that strong interest in philanthropy, which, you know, in his later years, I think actually took up more of his time than acting.
Well, I think he ended up making a lot of money with the salad dressing, more than he expected to. But, you know, he always seemed humble, like a regular guy. I mean, one of the things that he said was that after you've seen your face on the side of a, you know, salad dressing bottle, it's hard to take yourself seriously. If you check out Paul Newman in any movies where he looks like he's driving, he is driving, because he always insisted on driving, even though he was colorblind. And I want to leave you with the way he pictured his epitaph. Here lies Paul Newman, who died a failure because his eyes turned brown. And that's where we'll leave it for this week. Don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.